This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 1 week from today, the Senate Judiciary Committee begins confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Over the past several weeks, reporters, pundits, and legal scholars have pored over her decisions and debated everything from the pronunciation of her last name to her widely quoted remarks about the wisdom of Latinas. Barring surprises, she is widely expected to win confirmation before the August recess. So today, let's take a contrarian stance. What, if anything, have you learned about Judge Sotomayor that makes you skeptical? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, Todd Purdom joins us to parse the Palin resignation. He wrote a widely quoted profile of Alaska's governor for Vanity Fair. But first, what have we learned about Sonia Sotomayor? David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Always a pleasure to have you with us, David.
Hi, Neil.
And what have we learned that has come as a surprise?
Well, we haven't learned a lot that is going to appears like it's really going to put Judge Sotomayor in a really bad light. I suppose the most controversial thing is some of the speeches she gave, one in particular in 2001. You alluded to it earlier. Let me read you the quote. This was at a conference of Latinos, and it was about the need to get more Hispanics on the bench. So she was sort of speaking in that context. But in the speech, she talked about how her background as a Latino woman influences her, that it would make a difference in her judging. Here's what she said. Whether born from experience or inherent physiological or cultural differences, our gender and national origins may and will make a difference in our judging. I would hope that a wise Latina woman, with the richness of her experiences, would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life. Now, that's the line that, to some degree, sort of played in to the conservative concern about her, that President Obama had talked about finding judges with empathy, judges who could identify with different people. And then his first nominee, Judge Sotomayor, seemed to be saying that I will view things differently because of my background. And then a lot of people, at least some critics, jump to the next conclusion, which is that she won't judge fairly. She'll tilt the balance in favor of certain groups, minority groups perhaps, than against white males. I don't think there's a lot of evidence on the third point, but that was the concern.
And that the use of the word better conclusion than a white male led some to lay allegations of racism.
Yes. I think that her statement, when I've heard people defend it, it's relatively easy to defend the proposition that the Supreme Court, or any court, is better off if you have judges with different experiences. So if the question was, is it a good thing to put on the Supreme Court a woman and a Latina, I think most people would say, yes, absolutely. It adds to the whole. It's good to have justices with a variety of experiences. But on the other hand, if you're saying that I've got some superior wisdom because of my background and I'll decide cases that way, a lot of conservatives said, imagine if a white male judge had said the same thing in reverse. I believe that my background as a white male would make me reach better conclusions than a Latino woman.
Some of the critics have also focused on her demeanor in a piece that was published before her nomination actually came through. Jeffrey Rosen. Got my Jeffreys confused. Wrote a piece that quoted some in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, where she now works, as saying she's a bit of a bully in the court.
Yes, that was sort of a controversial piece because some of these were sort of anonymous people quoted talking about judges. I don't know what to make of that. A lot of people have said, my goodness, it's hard to get feistier or more like a bully in court at times than Justice Scalia, for example. He's famous for giving lawyers a hard time, and nobody says, Justice Scalia is not a good member of the Supreme Court because he asks sharp questions. So I think that criticism has, to some degree, faded. We will see, I think, at the hearings, there is a possibility that if she gets into fairly sharp exchanges with some of the senators, that theme may return.
There is, I'm sure, there are rehearsals ongoing where people are playing the role of senators asking sharp questions, and she is being counseled as to the best approach.
Yes, absolutely. Part of the what you want to do at a hearing like that is not be too talkative and too smart. You don't want to, the best opening is always to say, that's a very thoughtful question, Senator. That's a very interesting question. And then not the judge or justice can sort of give an answer that doesn't give away too much. You don't have to ask you don't have to really answer the very hardest questions, because you can say, that issue may come before me on the Supreme Court. People tell me, by the way, that she broke her ankle at LaGuardia Airport, and I'm told she's still having a lot of pain, and it's of some difficulty for her. So one comment I heard about the preparation is that one of the hardest things she's dealing with is the fact that she's still suffering from this broken ankle.
David Savage with us from the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. What, if anything, gives you pause about Judge Sotomayor's nomination to the Supreme Court? Let's start with Lou. Lou calling us from St. Louis.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I am very upset that they're thinking about putting yet another Catholic on the Supreme Court. Devout Catholics have very firm beliefs against abortion for any reason. They don't believe in contraception. They believe in having allotted children, and we're having a population explosion here. I see a lot of good reasons not to have another Catholic on the Supreme Court. We've got, what is it, five or six already?
David Savage?
We have five.
Okay, she'll make six.
True enough, I have not heard a lot of criticism on that score. As you say, we've already got five. She is not known for having particularly conservative views in line with some of the...
She was brought up in a Catholic school, was she not?
She certainly was.
Okay. That's my point.
Well, she's not written any decisions on abortion, and there are some on the left, David Savage, who question her whether she agrees with a right of privacy. That will be one of the questions, certainly, at her confirmation hearings.
I suspect on that, Neil, that she will say that I will stand by precedent. I'd be very surprised if Sonia Sotomayor was somebody who wants to overturn Roe versus Wade, for example, if that was the issue. There's no sign in her background of that. I do think it's possible, though, that she might be somewhere in the middle on some of these questions, because a lot of the hard questions that come up to the Supreme Court are, can the government regulate abortion? Not ban it, but regulate it. And it's possible she may be on the moderate to conservative side on some of those issues.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Lou.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Joining us now is Stephen Carter, the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale and the author of an upcoming novel, Jericho's Fall. He's known Supreme Court Justice, soon to be perhaps Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, since they attended law school together at Yale, and joins us from a studio at Yale in New Haven. Nice to have you with us in the program today.
I'm pleased to be here, Neil. Thank you.
And you were also at one point edited Sonia Sotomayor.
I did. I edited the student note that she wrote for the Yale Law Journal. This is 30 years ago now. But what's striking about the Sonia who wrote that note is it's the same Sonia Sotomayor you see in her opinions, which seem to me, and I teach some of them in class, to be thoughtful and even a hand. And what's really lovely about them, what makes them such beautiful teaching tools, is that she tends to get the law right and to lay out the law in some detail in explaining how she came to her conclusions. I might add, I heard David Savage mentioning earlier, and a lot of people have, these quotes from these speeches she's given, but there's plenty of political science work that tells us the best predictor of what a judge is going to do on the Supreme Court is what the judge did as an appellate judge. They tend to write the same sorts of opinions, reaching the same sorts of conclusions. So I think if you want to know what kind of justice she's likely to be, you've got to actually read the opinions as opposed to these few little speeches that are floating around.
And those opinions, you and others have been through them, you perhaps more closely than others, as you say, you teach them.
Yeah, I do. And I think as a set, it's really quite a remarkable set of opinions. She's written almost 400 opinions, and most of them fairly uncontroversial. Most cases we tend to forget are fairly uncontroversial. When we think of the Supreme Court, we think of abortion or gay rights or the rights of criminal defendants. But the truth is that the great majority of cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court are simply dismissed because the cases are so easy and straightforward. There are a couple of opinions of hers I know that have given some people a pause. There's, for example, her dissenting opinion regarding whether statutes barring felons from the vote are covered by the Voting Rights Act. There are a few like that, but they tend to be small and scattered. They're not the central part of her work. I think if you look at the central part of her work, you see a fairly middle-of-the-road judge who leans heavily in the direction, I would say, of government authority.
And some have said, and I know you've written about this, but some have pointed out that she's been reversed by the Supreme Court 60% of the time.
Yeah, I've heard that statistic from some of her opponents. It's a little bit misleading. Only five of her decisions have ever been taken by the Supreme Court, and three were certainly overturned. But the Supreme Court takes very few appeals and overturns about 75% of them. So she's actually a little below the rate of judges whose opinions are appealed. I might add that Justice Alito, who's currently serving on the Supreme Court, had only two cases taken by the court while he was a Court of Appeals judge, and they were both overturned. So by the logic of Sotomayor's critics, Alito had a reversal rate of 100%.
And in either case, two or five, it's hardly a large statistical sample.
The number is far too small to draw any conclusions. That's correct.
We're talking with Stephen Carter. He's the author of a new novel, Jericho's Fall, that comes out next week, published by Knopf, and he's the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale. Of course, also with us is David Savage, who covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. What gives you pause, if anything, about the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court of the United States? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Next week, Judge Sonia Sotomayor faces the Senate Judiciary Committee, where she hopes to be confirmed as the next justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. It's the Senate's responsibility to advise and consent. Today, we're asking you to advise, if not consent, to this nomination. What, if anything, have you learned about Judge Sotomayor that makes you skeptical? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Reporter David Savage is with us. He covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune. So also is Yale professor and novelist Stephen Carter. And let's see if we can get somebody else on the line. Let's go to Rick. And Rick's with us from Yardley, Pennsylvania.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Talk of the Nation is a great program every day.
Thank you.
There's a few things that should disqualify her as a Supreme Court judge. The one most frightening and surprisingly least reported is that she feels that the Bill of Rights are not individual liberties, that they're not all individual liberties, but instead limitations on federal government, leaving crooked state governments free to run roughshod over our inalienable and natural rights. And the two others, quickly, are she arrogantly believes the Supreme Court cannot make a bad decision and that racial discrimination is okay in certain circumstances.
And on the Bill of Rights, are you talking about the Second Amendment case?
Specifically, and maybe more. I only know that she feels that one is not an individual right. That's one of the Bill of Rights, and she believes it is not an individual right.
David Savage, this regarded the use of not firearms, but nunchucks.
Yes, strangely enough. This is a very difficult debate about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution that took place before most of us were born. You know, the original Bill of Rights begins with the phrase, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion and freedom of speech. For most of American history, the Bill of Rights was seen as only limiting federal government. During the 1930s and 40s, the Supreme Court started to say certain rights are so basic that we're going to say that they also apply to the state and local governments. They did that with freedom of speech, religion, unreasonable searches. There were no Second Amendment decisions in the middle part of the 20th century. And in the late 1800s, the court had said very explicitly that the Second Amendment limits only the federal government. So when the issue has come up recently, some judges on lower courts, like Sonia Sotomayor, have done what they almost had to say, which was the Supreme Court precedents still on the books say the Second Amendment limits only the federal government. This case from a year ago came from the District of Columbia, a federal enclave, and the Supreme Court said, we're not deciding the issue of whether the Second Amendment applies to states. It seems like a technicality, but if you're a lower court judge, you're sort of stuck with the precedents of the Supreme Court. I think the court will overturn that this year, and then they will extend the Second Amendment to state and local laws.
Stephen Carter?
Yeah, I actually agree with most of what David has said. I think that most scholars I know are pretty comfortable with the idea that the Second Amendment doesn't apply to the states. I disagree with that. I think the court was wrong in the 19th century. I think the entire Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment, applies to the states, and whatever restrictions are placed on federal regulation of firearms have to be placed on state regulation as well. I might add, Rick, in his call, raised the question of whether Judge Sotomayor takes the view the Supreme Court can never be wrong. And it's important to remember that as a Court of Appeals judge as a district court judge, she would have no choice but to apply Supreme Court precedent. As a member of the Supreme Court, she will have an opportunity to have her say on whether the court has been wrong in the past.
Rick, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go next to Pablo. Pablo with us in Princeton.
Hi there. One of the concerns that I've had, I heard some remarks that she had made about judges being necessarily policymakers. And I'm surprised that more people haven't picked up on that as sort of putting her out there to be a judicial activist, which is not something that I think that we need in the Supreme Court, and I'm just wondering what your guests might have to say on that.
And Stephen Carter, this was the quote we used at the beginning of the program where she said that the Court of Appeals is where policy is made.
Well, let me answer the question in two ways. The first and obvious answer is one can say that all law is, in a sense, policy. It would be nice if we had judges who were simply robots mechanistically applying the precedents. And there are some precedents can be applied that way, but mostly they can't. That's why we have Court of Appeals judges, because they have to struggle with difficult applications of precedent. But then second, I do think that the judging process can be very complex. There's a quote. Everyone's been reading these quotes from Sonny. There's a quote, actually, that I'd like to read from Benjamin Cardozo, one of the great jurists of the 20th century, in his famous book, The Nature of the Judicial Process. Cardozo wrote, he, meaning the judge, he must balance all his ingredients, his philosophy, his logic, his analogies, his history, his customs, his sense of right, and all the rest, and adding a little here and taking a little there, must determine as wisely as he can which weight shall tip the scales.
David?
You know, that policymaking quote was sort of taken out of context, reasonably so, because she said it, and she'll be asked about it and forced to explain it. But I listened to that. This was a session at Duke University. It was a group of law students. And in this part of the program, they were talking about if you want to be a clerk, would it be better to be clerk for a trial judge or an appellate court judge? And she had been both. And so she was advising the students sort of on the difference. And the difference is if you're a district judge, she said, you're totally focused on that person's case, that individual case and the facts. She said the Court of Appeals is different because you make policy, meaning you don't just look at that case. You set the law for the whole the whole region, and you cover a lot of cases. So she was trying to make the point that it may have been the wrong word, but that the Court of Appeals, you look more widely and broadly at the law, shaping the law, whereas a district judge, you only decide that case. That's the point she was trying to make in that exchange.
Pablo, thank you. Here's an email from Susan in Portland, Oregon. Jeffrey Deskovich, an innocent man, was kept in prison an additional 7 years because Judge Sotomayor refused to consider his case when his attorney was given an inaccurate deadline for filing an appeal and missed the deadline. Keeping an innocent man in prison because of such a technicality is not acceptable, especially when considering a privately paid defense attorney might not have made the same mistake. Are you familiar with that case, Stephen Carter?
I have to say that one got by me. David Savage, do you know that case?
I don't. I'm sorry.
I wish I could answer the email, but I'm afraid that although I've read a lot of her decisions, that one I've missed.
All right. Well, we'll get back. We'll see what we can find out about that case and get back before the hearings start. This from Michael in Cincinnati. What gives me pause about Judge Sotomayor is that she has never been judged fairly at any point in her life, but has been the beneficiary of affirmative action at every critical point. For example, she did not earn her moniker as valedictorian, but was simply given it. She would not have been admitted to Princeton but for her race, same for Yale Law School, and the same for the federal bench. In other words, by every measure that applies to everyone but minorities, Judge Sotomayor was not good enough, but merely handed admissions and jobs that she truly did not deserve, yet she claims that she is better than white males, going back to that quote about the wisdom of Latinas. I wonder, Stephen Carter, what you might have to say about that.
I'm a little astonished. I'm sorry that Michael seems so irritated. My recollection is that Sonia Sotomayor was summa cum laude at Princeton, which means she had one of the very highest grade point averages in her graduating class, so it's not surprising to me that she got into Yale Law School. I have no idea what role any particular factor played in her selection as anything she's done. All I can say is that each thing she's been selected to do, she's performed excellently. And indeed, if you look at her record in college, her record in law school, her record as a prosecutor, her record as a judge for these many years, it's difficult to look at any of those and say that she wasn't entitled to be there and didn't do a truly exceptional job.
Let me ask you, David, there is a distinct distinction between the way she looks at her status as an affirmative action baby. She admits that she got into Princeton because of that, as opposed to Clarence Thomas, who might be her fellow justice on the Supreme Court.
Yes, it is true. They came away from that experience with very different views. I sort of share Stephen's view that I don't know what her high school test scores or grades were like, but anybody who goes to Princeton and graduates with the highest undergraduate award and with the highest honors seems to me has done pretty well. I mean, that does not, I don't think you need to make excuses for anybody like that getting into the Yale Law School. You're right. She has come away as saying that affirmative action is about sort of opening doors, giving opportunities, giving people a chance to do well. She did well, and she's glad she had the opportunity. Clarence Thomas viewed it as he got these opportunities, but it ended up demeaning him and diminishing his own accomplishments. So he's got sort of a sour view of affirmative action as a way that it, as I say, sort of takes away from his, he views it as having taken away from his accomplishments.
Now let's say one more call on this. Bobby with us from Kansas City.
Hi, I was just wondering if, while we're talking about diversity among nominees to the Supreme Court, whether we should have nominees from somewhere other than Harvard or Yale Law School.
Stephen Carter, I guess that one's to you.
Well, but, you know, I actually agree with the caller on that in a way. That is to say, I really do think it's important to have people of a broad range of backgrounds on the Supreme Court across all sorts of measures. I remember that I was a law clerk many years ago for the great Justice Thurgood Marshall, and he used to say that one of the reasons he himself was glad he was on the court was not because he was black, but because he was the only member of the court who had ever sat inside a police interrogation room. And so he knew what the experience was like. And I think it is not the case that all the great judges go to Harvard and Yale. Many great judges did go to Harvard and Yale. Many great legal minds did. But there's a wealth of experience out there we tend not to tap in our kind of Washington-centered focus as we go about selecting justice. So I agree with that. That takes nothing from Sonia, who I hope and believe will be confirmed, and rightfully so. But I do think in future it would be good to spread the net more widely.
Thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Stephen Carter is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale, and his upcoming novel, Jericho's Fall, comes out shortly. He was with us today from a studio at Yale University in New Haven. He wrote the article, The Sonia I Know, for the Daily Beast. You can find a link to that on our website at npr.org. David Savage, as always, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Neil.
And David Savage covers the Supreme Court for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. And Joining us next is Dave Zirin, who is not a Supreme Court columnist or legal pundit. He writes for Slam Magazine and is a regular contributor to The Nation and the author of the book Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and the Promise of Sports. And he joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back in the program,
Dave. Oh, great to be here. Thank you.
And one of the things we wanted to talk about with you is that Judge Sonia Sotomayor has made two landmark decisions that involved the law and sports.
Absolutely. Over the last 25 years, by chance, Sonia Sotomayor has laid judgment on the two most important legal cases that have affected the major sports in this country. The first one was in 1995. Sonia Sotomayor cast the decision against Major League Baseball's owners, stopping the strike that canceled the World Series in 94, the only time the World Series has ever been canceled. It lasted through two World Wars and a Great Depression, could not survive the battle between the Union and the owners. The second case was very famously about 4 years back. It was the NFL versus Maurice Claret, the Ohio State running back who wanted to go into the NFL and not wait the requisite 3 years that the NFL requires.
Now we're talking with Dave Zirin, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And that first case that President Obama mentioned nominating Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, that
it's
she was the judge who saved baseball.
Saved baseball. That was a big laugh line when he introduced her. But I went back and looked at the columns written by various sports columnists in 1995 when she made her decision, bringing the players, putting them back on the field. And it was interesting. Like, you had columnists say things like, she will go down in history with Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio as one of the saviors of baseball. But it's interesting. Like, I actually think that there's something we can learn about Sonia Sotomayor as a justice by looking at these sports decisions. It's an interesting window.
What does it tell you?
Well, it tells me a couple things. First is that she is very brisk and very no-nonsense. You read the decisions and she's taking no guff from either party in each one. She's like, what? You guys have been on strike for 278 days and locked out for that long? Back on the field.
And I gather, heard the case, retired for half an hour and came back and read a 45-minute decision.
Exactly. So brisk.
Might have been ready.
Yes, brisk and ready. The other thing is, it's interesting, is that in both decisions, there's a very strong pro-union bent in both decisions. Like, she castigates the owners in the baseball decision to say that what the owners are doing are effectively trying to collectively bargain away the existence of the union. She says, no, that's not what collective bargaining is for. You can't do that.
And the Maurice Claret decision, though, it seems remarkable on the face of it. You can say, here's an 18-year-old man, 19-year-old man, and he's not provided the right to employment.
Right. And she used a union rationale for that one as well, saying that the union has a right to decide who does or doesn't get to work under their umbrella. And if the union says we don't want people until they're 3 years out of high school, then the union is correct. So if you think about it, both decisions are in a way also very conservative. Like, she protects the status quo in the NFL. And in the baseball one, I mean, it was the owners in that lockout strike that I think, and that other baseball writers think, it was the union's owners who were the radicals. They were trying to take all the agreements that existed in baseball for decades and turn them on its head. And she was the one who said, you know what, you guys are headed off a cliff. You need to get back on the field.
And despite the decision, which is decried by some, baseball seems to have done very well in the meantime.
Oh, very well. I mean, if you look at the last 13, 14, 15 years in baseball, some would say it's had an anabolic injection, but there's no question that... That's another issue, which we've discussed in the past, but profits for the game have gone up over 700% over that period.
And do you think that she's going to be asked about Chief Justice Roberts' famous declaration that, a judge really needs to be a lot like an umpire?
That'll be an interesting thing if she's asked that. And you know what? There are a lot of baseball personalities, particularly players, who will say she's the best umpire we ever had.
It's interesting. You also note in your piece, she's a Yankee fan.
She is a Yankees fan growing up in the South Bronx, as some of those folks tend to be. I was born in Brooklyn, so I have a little bit of a different mindset on this. Brooklyn Dodgers, of course, even though I'm far too young to have rooted for them. But she is a Yankees fan, which some people in Boston might say should disqualify her from any promotions whatsoever.
Her team is currently, at last check, losing to the Toronto Blue Jays 4-0. So
painful.
Her ankle may hurt more than that. Dave Zirin, thanks very much for your time today.
Oh, my privilege. Thank you.
Dave Zirin writes for Slam Magazine. He's a regular contributor to The Nation and the author of the book Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and Promise of Sports. And he joined us today in Studio 3A. You can find a link to his article about Judge Sotomayor's sports decisions on our website at npr.org. Coming up, Sarah Palin says she is neither a lame duck nor a dead fish. We'll sort out the menagerie with Vanity Fair's Todd Purdom. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.